So now I'd like to introduce Liam. Liam Parry has been a member of Socialist Alternative for half a decade. Now he's in the RMIT Club of Socialist Alternative and is a education activist, among other things. So please make him welcome.
Okay, so questions surrounding ultra-leftism and ultra-left politics, I think, are going to be a feature in any revolutionary period. This is because, like, the mass shift in consciousness that occurs during a revolution is always uneven. No one ever enters the, a revolutionary struggle or a revolutionary period with all the questions worked out beforehand, and certainly the majority of the working class and a revolutionary movement won't have solved all these questions before a revolution. So, in a lot of revolutionary situations, there's always, isolated sections of a movement that become quite radical and can radicalise in isolation from the broader movement and broader working class struggle. These people can be inspired by, mass struggle, revolutionary activity, but not necessarily be conscious about what's possible in any concrete particular moment. And the November Revolution in 1918 in Germany was kicked off by mass revolt and inspiring upsurges against the barbarities of capitalism and of World War I. Soldiers and sailors mutinied, workers went on strike, and set up workers' councils in emulation of the Russian Revolution, which had happened a year previous. And this mass revolutionary upsurge inspired millions of people in Germany to engage in left-wing politics, anti-capitalist ideas and struggle for the first time in their lives. And for those who were previously already on the radical left, it showed that the kind of socialist revolution that had happened previously in Russia was possible also in the more economically advanced Germany. However, when confronted with the German Revolution, the traditional leaders of the workers' movement in the SPD, or the Social Democratic Party, and the leadership of the trade unions chose instead to defend capitalism rather than extend the revolution. Their leaders opposed calls for the foundation of a socialist republic, and they used their influence and positions in the workers' movement to keep revolutionary strike waves from getting out of their control and from challenging the rule of capital outright. By the end of 1918, they had bureaucratically stripped the workers' councils that were founded in the revolution. They'd bureaucratically stripped these councils of most of their power and authority and subordinated them to a capitalist parliamentary system represented in the National Assembly. And once in government, after the elections, the SPD and the trade union leaders continued to betray the workers' revolution and the movement against German capitalism. So one, in government, they initiated murderous offensives against any workers that attempted to extend and deepen the revolution. And some of these, some of the most renowned and influential political leaders of the revolutionary left in Germany were murdered by these counter-revolutionary assaults organised by the SPD. So one of the main tasks for revolutionaries then in Germany had to be to expose the SPD as not defenders of workers' rights or the struggle for socialism, but instead an enemy of the revolution. However, this task raises several other questions about how revolutionaries should relate to workers when they're in a minority, how they should relate to the millions of workers in Germany that would still look to the SPD and the trade unions for political leadership. And from the start of the revolution, ultra-left politics were a barrier to fulfilling this revolutionary project. So at the founding congress of the Communist Party, the KPD, the German Communist Party, a majority of delegates voted in favour of ultra-left positions, against intervention into the National Assembly and against intervention into the trade unions. And so I just want to talk a little bit about these debates. The debate around intervention into Parliament is often portrayed by ultra-left accounts of the Congress and of the revolution as being about whether or not there's a parliamentary road to socialism. Often the ultra-lefts accuse the leadership of the KPD of arguing that the party should take up the same attitude to Parliament that the SPD did. Nothing, well, that's, you know, factually not true, and it's clear when you read the arguments that are made by Paul Levy in his introduction to the debate at the Congress. Levy begins his introduction to the debate by stating that the path of the proletariat to victory can only pass over the corpse of the National Assembly. And what that, what actually the leadership around Luxembourg and Levy, I'm still not sure how to say his name, what they were arguing was not that, you know, socialism can come about through parliamentary reform, but instead they were arguing that communists had a responsibility to intervene into key debates that were happening in the revolution. And given that the workers' councils had, you know, only just recently voted to subordinate themselves to the National Assembly, it was incumbent upon the communists to intervene into these elections, because most workers were going to take part in them and look to the debates that happened around these elections as being central to the direction of the revolutionary movement. The counter-argument at the Congress was led by Otto Ruhl, who argued that the KPD should instead campaign for an immediate seizure of power by the workers' councils. And this was just an absolute fantasy, given that the leadership of these councils had only, you know, weeks previously stated that they had no desire to do so, and they, you know, just voted to subordinate themselves to the National Assembly. On the question of trade unions, ultra-left attitudes were even more widespread among the party and the, you know, people involved in the foundation of the party. And so although the session on trade unions that happens at this Congress is shorter and a lot of the debates are kind of, don't reach the same sort of, are not had out as thoroughly as around Parliament, it's notable that nobody in the leadership of the KPD or any of the delegates, as far as I have been able to find, actually argued for systematic intervention into the trade union movement. The more extreme ultra-left sections of the Congress supported Paul Froelich's proposed slogan, which was that the party should call for all workers to leave the unions. To organised workers, this would not have been seen as a revolutionary statement, but as an attack on the, you know, main organisations of workers' struggle at the time. And even Rosa Luxemburg at the Congress states that the liquidation of the trade unions is on the immediate agenda. And basically, yeah, no one actively argues that, revolutionaries should build a militant opposition within the trade union, the existing trade unions. So I think that the state of ultra-left politics at the founding Congress is partly a product of the historical development of the German left and the revolutionaries. These revolutionaries that founded the KPD were mostly trained and cohered through the political debates that occurred within the SPD in the decades before the revolution. These debates were took place between, individual revolutionaries, radicals like Luxembourg or Karl Liebknecht, as well as, future ultra-lefts like Ruhl or Anton Paneckerk. And the debates, they took the form of individual revolutionaries arguing against the parliamentary representatives of the SPD and the trade unions. And from the perspective of the leftists, these forces appeared to be a monolithic block of, right-wing accommodationist and opportunist politics. It seems, to the revolutionaries that these forces had been corrupted by the bureaucracies that they ran. And so in this context, I think it's not surprising that a lot of the revolutionaries defined their politics through a rejection of parliament and of trade unions. I also do think that there's a political basis for some of the ultra-left attitudes in the way that a lot of the revolutionaries, Luxembourg as well, I think, write about revolutionary politics and their stress on, the ability for spontaneous workers' struggle to just overcome any bureaucratic elements of the workers' movement. I think for many in the party, some people have take this, to a more ultra-left position than others, but for many in the KPD, this sort of an attitude, an orientation to spontaneous struggle, could lead to a dismissal of the ability of the reformists and the trade unions to hold the struggle back. And this is particularly misorienting, I think, in Germany, where, you know, you have things like mass revolutionary, you know, like the massive proliferation of revolutionary and radical ideas among millions of workers, the formation of workers' councils, revolutionary strike waves, huge radical demonstrations. And yet, throughout this movement, the reformist leadership of the SPD and the trade unions remain in a dominant position in the workers' movement, and they're able to use this position to you know stem the tide of the revolution. Okay, so even though I think there are problems with what like even Luxembourg or you know how some of the less ultra left you know elements of the KPD and the leadership, I think there were some problems with their politics. I think in general, they actually do have the right approach to communist strategy. And this is indicated, I think, when you read the program of the Spartacist League. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there that I think is you know indicates a general correct attitude to how communists should relate to a revolutionary struggle. So they say, it's written by Luxembourg and Levi. They say the socialist revolution can be brought to victory only by the great majority of the working people themselves. The Spartacist League will never take over governmental power except in response to the clear, unambiguous will of the great majority of the proletarian mass of all Germany, never except by the proletariat's conscious affirmation of the views, aims, and methods of struggle of the Spartacist League. The victory of the Spartacist League comes not at the beginning but at the end of the revolution. It is identical with the victory of the great million-strong masses of the socialist proletariat. And these sort of themes, I think, run through the programmatic writings of Luxembourg and Levi in this period. So Luxembourg, you know, she sees revolution as an act of the whole working class. It's not something that can be willed into the existence through the actions of a small party or of a radical minority. And she sees the proletariat as only being able to be won to revolutionary politics through a deepening of struggle. She emphasises that revolutionaries, therefore, have to be sensitive to the attitudes of the entire class and not get carried away by an appetite for radicalism within a minority. And the ultra-lefts, they either reject this orientation or they reject reality. Some claim that the workers' councils can take power against the will of the leadership of the councils and the you know, influential leaders of the the workers' movement. Others at the Congress claim that the Spartacists can take power and win the support of the majority of the class on the basis solely of street demonstrations. So you have people in there saying, you know, we've won the debate. We've won the debate on the streets. But none of them really have any clue what's going on in the factories, for instance. These ultra-left ideas also, they could appeal to many of the inexperienced radicals who were formed that KPD. So the party was formed by a fusion between the Spartacist League and the International Communists of Germany, the IKD. And the Spartacist League in November only had about 3,000 members. And most of these were, you know, involved in small local groups that, you know, would hand out party like leaflets of the league, but, you know, had general political autonomy from the rest of the party. So there's very little political cohesion and agreement on a national level. Often, like, you know, for some people, it was like they're, you know, they get involved for the first time during the war. And the IKD was much, much smaller than the Spartacist League. So the people, the founding conference delegates, they were inexperienced. They also represented no real organised force within the workers' movement. So they had no real way to assess what the state of revolutionary consciousness and activity was within the workers' movement in their own areas, let alone at like a national level. And so what was really needed in this moment was more than just spontaneous struggle and you know isolated radicalism of a minority. The revolutionaries needed a large political party capable of challenging the reformists for leadership of the workers' movement. If the revolutionaries, you know, if the people who went on to found the Spartacist League and the KPD, if they had built a you know party independent of the leadership of the SPD before World War I, this sort of a grouping, you know, could have developed a larger layer of you know. Political leaders that were used to, you know, traversing the or like understanding the questions and problems that come up in mass struggle, they could have developed a better understanding or a deeper understanding of Marxist theory and how to apply this to political situations. And additionally, I think if they had organised a revolutionary opposition to the leadership of the SPD, they wouldn't have just had to fight in on the terrain of politics. It wouldn't have just been about reform versus revolution. But they would have had to figure out how to organise workers on an explicitly revolutionary basis, like in the long term. And I think this would have encouraged them to, you know, actually clarify their ideas more about how to relate to trade unions and how to relate to day-to-day struggles, non-revolutionary struggles that workers engage in. So basically, like, I think ultra-leftism in Germany, it's not just a clear, clarified set of politics. It's not just about particular individuals or groups. But I think it's more useful to conceive of ultra-leftism as being basically like a mood within the revolutionary movement in Germany. And it's a mood that's produced by a lack of political clarity and like organisational weaknesses, lack of experience, that kind of thing. So for instance, the premature uprising in January 1919 is not necessarily the product of worked-out theoretical desire to force the pace of a revolution. But it's much more, I think, of an organic, ultra-leftism. Of people, you know, getting carried away by the radicalism of street demonstrations, of inexperienced, newly radicalised activists around the KPD, seeing, you know, radicalism on the streets and thinking that it applied everywhere throughout Germany. And so in January, these layers can encourage Liebknecht and sections of the revolutionary shock stewards movement as well, to think that they can proclaim a socialist revolution just on the basis of these, you know, mass demonstrations. And the people probably might be aware, but the uprising doesn't go particularly well. It's brutally repressed by the SPD, and it's, you know, this is a period of, it, you know, precedes a period of counter-revolution in which, you know, Luxembourg and Liebknecht and, one of their collaborators, Jörg Eaches, were all murdered. There's an organic mood, I think, that grips sections of the revolutionary movement. But it is the case that this mood then does get crystallised into various individuals and organisations and theories. So I do want to talk about those as well. So I'll start with the KAPD, the Communist Workers' Party of Germany. The KAPD is formed not on a particularly clear political basis initially. It includes people of all sorts of different persuasions. And it's formed when the ultra-lefts are expelled from the party in 1919. And so really the only thing that unites them at this stage is a hostility to the leadership of the KPD and a hostility as well to like other institutions of the communist movement internationally. And so initially it even includes people who are actually quite right-wing, like Fritz Wolfheim and Heinrich Laufenberg, who are early sort of people who took up the theories of national Bolshevism, which is like quite a right-wing tendency. In the long term, two distinct tendencies emerged within the KAPD. One was towards syndicalism, the syndicalism of like people like Otto Ruhl. The other was towards the politics of people like Anton Paniker and Hermann Gorder, who basically, I would argue, glorify the activity of a sect. So I'll start with Otto Ruhl, though. He's famous for being one of the first SPD parliamentarians, along with the Karl Liebknecht, to vote against the war in the Reichstag. He was also a founding member of the Spartacus League and of the KPD, which gives you a sense of the political, like the lack of real political, like clarity or cohesion that Otto Ruhl is also, you know, a leading figure in this. Because even at the Congress, like I said, he argues against participation in Parliament. And particularly after getting, and even before as well, after as well as before getting expelled, he quite quickly ends up, you know, rejecting the need for any sort of political organisation for revolutionaries in the revolution. So instead he argues for the formation of syndicalist trade unions, separate from the mainstream ones, to lead the revolution. Paniker and Gorder, on the other hand, they cloak their ultra-leftism in more formal, orthodox Marxist positions. So if you read what they write, They don't explicitly reject the need for political organisation. They talk about the need for class consciousness to develop, to rely on workers' struggle from below. They have a critique of bureaucratism in the workers' movement. They also have various references to the historical development of the left and for the need for, like, you know, socialist tactics to relate to, you know, concrete historical moments and that. And a lot of what they write abstractly, I think, seems similar to what Luxembourg writes and, you know, yeah, and what the, you know, less ultra-left sections of the revolutionaries in Germany, what they write. But they do come to the same conclusions as the rest of the ultra-lefts. They argue for an abstention from all non-revolutionary struggles and all non-revolutionary institutions in a revolutionary period. Yeah, I think partly this is because they, like more than others, they theorise a pretty unilinear conception of how class struggle class consciousness develops. They kind of just see it as just happening spontaneously without the intervention of, you know, of radicals. And more, it's like after the, you know, revolutionary consciousness is reached, that's when the KAPD is, you know, supposed to grow. So they write that, you know, when there are setbacks in the revolution, they just end up saying that, well, it's a shame. It's a shame that workers' consciousness and spiritual development was lacking and that... You know, what this means is that the real revolution is actually a long way off. So they end up drawing quite conservative conclusions from it all. And, you know, the other thing is that it lets the KAPD off the hook because, you know, the inability of the workers' movement to achieve revolutionary consciousness, it's not through any fault of Pannekoek and Gorda, but it's, you know, basically their orientation is to blame workers for not being radical enough. Yeah, so Pannekoek and Gorda, I think they just end up glorifying the sect-like existence of the KAPD. You know, the KAPD never really reaches a period, and they don't either, reach this sort of period of mass influence within the workers' movement in Germany. Their sort of extreme hostility to all of the institutions of workers' struggle, basically, like the trade unions and that, and all of the you know, non-revolutionary political parties. Means that, you know, they never really play any serious role in the revolution in terms of organising class struggle or you know, deepening the revolution. They're always isolated. I think that one of the things is, like, so the stuff that Pannekoek and Gorda say can kind of seem abstractly to be better, but I don't really think that that's the case because in terms of, like, what effect they ended up did have on the revolution... It was less about, like, the struggle as a whole. I think more that the role that they play is to put more pressure on sections in the KPD and in the Comintern that are soft on ultra-leftism. You know, the fact that they utilise more Marxist terminology means that people who, within the rest of the revolutionary movement, who are soft on these politics, think that these people are to be taken seriously. You know, so I think they inflate the importance of these figures. And overestimate their ability to be won as well, I think. And at any rate, like, even though, like, Pannekoek and Gorda, they kind of play this role of, in some ways, politically cohering the KAPD in a way, but the majority of the party doesn't really, like, take on their politics that in that, like, serious a way. Like, that. So the KAPD participate in the march action. They do attempt to force the pace of events all the time, even though Pannekoek and Gorda say, well, it's impossible because the workers are too right-wing. So, you know, they can kind of provide a political rationale for the organisational separation between the KAPD and the rest of the communist movement. But they don't, like, their politics isn't actually put into practice, I don't think, you know, consistently. Yeah. Well, I think probably the more damaging... and more influential within the communist movement form of ultra-leftism is the theory of the offensive. I think one of the reasons why this was more damaging and more, you know, well, worse, was partly because it was promoted not just by people within the KPD, but it was also promoted heavily by the leadership of the Comintern around Zinoviev and Bukharin. You know, the Comintern, they send Bela Kun as a Comintern emissary to Germany to agitate around this particular idea. they go so far as to engineer what I think is basically should just be described as a secret factional struggle within the leadership of the KPD to attempt to isolate Paul Levi and the rest of the leadership, or the less ultra left sections of the leadership. They say that these people are rightists, that they're a conservative drag on both the party and the revolution. And a number of leading figures go along with this this theory, even when they really should have known better. And at previous periods, they argued implicitly, were critical of this sort of orientation around the theory of the offensive. So people like Karl Radek and Brandler and that, who previously supported the open letter tactic, give in to the pressures to support the theory of the offensive. So this theory claimed that after the fusion with the USPD and the shop stewards, that the Communist Party was able to initiate a revolutionary struggle in and of its own influence in the movement. It could change the course of the revolution due to its increased size and weight in Germany. And you could see how this would be appealing to people who had been involved in the revolution now for 2-3 years. They'd seen mass upsurges, crushing counter-revolutionary defeats. And now, finally, the party was a mass force with close to 500,000 members. And it's true that the massive growth did indicate a real change in what was possible for the party. It presented massive new opportunities and potential for the revolution. But the KPD was still a minority in the workers' movement, and their 500,000 members were dwarfed by the millions of non-revolutionary or unorganised workers in the union movement nationally. So you couldn't just assume that the Communist Party clicks its fingers and all these other workers will follow the party into any action. The theory of the offensive lays the basis for the march action, which I think is the most destructive sort of action, an ultra-left adventure in the revolution. And so after organisationally isolating Levi and the shop stewards from the leadership of the KPD, the new ultra-left leadership call a demonstration. They call for a revolutionary insurrectionary general strike, going so far as to fake false flag attacks on communists to provide justification for this. They argue that all workers, all members, and all workers should take up arms to fight for this insurrection. And they tell their members that if any workers don't obey this call for a general strike, which was marginal within the movement in general, that they should be labelled scabs. The party should get into fights with them and beat up these workers, basically. And the results of this action are devastating. Not only does it lead to redoubling down of repression for the party, not even the entire membership of the KPD take part in the march action. So in Berlin, they call demonstrations that that mobilise only 10,000 workers, which maybe seems like a lot, but it's a few months previously they'd attracted over 200,000 votes in the trade unions in Berlin for their programs for the trade unions. Hundreds of thousands of members of the KPD leave, along with some of the most experienced and capable, I think, leaders of the party, like people like Paul Levi and a bunch of the leaders of the Revolutionary Shop Stewards. And in general, the other thing that's really damaging about the theory of the offensive in the march action is that the factional struggle that's engineered by the people who support the theory, it creates a space for the development of a permanent ultra-left faction. And a deeply unprincipled and bureaucratic faction does form around, in particular, Ruth Fischer and Ernst Maslau in Berlin. And this faction continues to just play a fucking rotten role all the way through the revolution and after. The faction acts basically as a party within a party. It constantly disobeys, party discipline. It generally contributes and whips up a hyper-moralistic ultra-left sentiment against the party leadership in periods where they desire to, bureaucratically challenge the leadership. Okay, so obviously ultra-leftism was an extensive problem, and it's not something that you could just get away with, do away with easily. You can't just wish it away because it's a product of, you know, like the structural issues in the revolutionary left. But I don't think that the grip of the ultra-lefts was just some sort of fait accompli that people just had to accept. Often when people talk about the German Revolution, just like, well, they didn't build a party before, so whatever, like, it's all over by, like, 1914, basically. I don't think that, like, you can really have this attitude towards ultra-leftism in the party. There are a bunch of actually quite successful attempts throughout the history of the party to attempt to and begin to you know, loosen the hold of ultra-left sentiment in the party and in the movement more broadly. So I want to talk about three particular attempts to do this in Germany. The first attempt is in early 1919, and it's an attempt by the Russians and by the Comintern to win over a section of the leadership of the KPD to a more sensible strategy. So when previously figures like Levi had opposed the systematic intervention into the trade unions, after having extensive debates with Radek, he comes to agree with that position, and they end up forging like a leadership that not just included people like Paul Levi, who was not really an ultra-left in general, but it also includes former ultra-lefts like Paul Frolich, who, you know, are convinced by Radek's arguments. Radek writes a pamphlet as well that argues the positions of the party. It's called World Revolution and Communist Tactics. Couldn't find it in English, but it's the same title as a popular Panikkerk writing, and he's referencing and arguing against Radek. And another example of this sort of strategy is left-wing communism by Lenin. It's an attempt to make political arguments to convince ultra-left sections of the world communist movement. And like I said, I think there's some real success in this strategy. So you end up forging a leadership on a sane political line, and able to intervene sensibly into the revolutionary movement, where previously they were totally unable to do so. I think part of this, the reason why this is successful, is not just because they're good arguing, but the position of being in like a national leadership of a revolutionary organization means that some of these questions become more pertinent, and particularly as like the bankruptcy of the ultra-left strategy is proved in practice, I think people like Levi and Frolich become more open to the strategies and the tactics that are proposed by Radek. So, obviously the uprising in January 1919 is a disaster for the party. It trashes the party's reputation among sections of the working class. They're just seen as like adventurers and, like lunatics, basically, among sections of the organised workers' movement. But also, like, even after the January uprising, the ultra-left politics just makes the whole situation worse because, the sections of the party that are controlled by the ultra-lefts, like in Bremen and Hamburg and Berlin, these sections pass motions prohibiting trade union members from joining the party. And one of the things I was reading about is, like, that in the lead-up to the conference where they're all expelled, the leadership in Berlin goes so far as to try to expel Clara Zetkin for holding a seat in Parliament. So it's not just this thing that is purely... the conference at the end of 1919 isn't just purely initiated by Levi. It's clear that there's a confrontation coming and that the two strategies couldn't coexist in a useful way. And so the next attempt to lessen the hold of ultra-leftism was the Heidelberg Conference in 1919, where the leadership, basically expel the ultra-lefts and anybody who disagrees with the strategy of intervention into the trade unions. And this was a controversial decision. Both Lenin and Karl Radek opposed the split, and, like, for instance, Chris Harman suggests that he thinks it was a bad idea as well in his book, The Lost Revolution. And it's, the split was very substantial. It took over half the membership of the party initially, and it reduced the party to basically nothing in some important sections. Like, Hamburg and Bremen were important industrial districts, but also, like, they've become reduced to basically nothing in Berlin. However, the argument that Levi makes is that this is a necessary in order to preserve a Marxist character of the party and to prevent the party from totally going off the rails. As well as that, The argument for the split is based on a desire to attempt to reach out to the vanguard of the working class, who are mostly organised within the USPD and within the shop stewards movement, and the continuing presence of ultra-leftists in the party was a massive block to that. And the other thing about it is that I think it's important to say that it's a bureaucratic solution that doesn't get rid of the fundamental reasons why ultra-leftism is able to take hold in the party in general. I think that the only alternative really at this stage would have been to have a drawn-out factional political debate within the KPD. My personal opinion is that the middle of a revolution isn't really the time to be inward-looking, particularly when the USPD are radicalising sections of them, are shifting to the left and radically approaching communist politics. So I think the more immediate task really had to be winning over this section of the workers' movement. Another thing I want to say about the way that the ultra-left sort of talked about this split was that the leadership of the KPD, they were just like sort of tempering their real politics. They were like moderating their politics in order to avoid like scaring off workers. But I think that is a pretty cynical way of looking at it, because they're trying to convince the revolutionary shop stewards, who were not scared of like radical revolutionary struggles. A lot of them participated and were murdered in the January uprising. The problem was that these organised workers politically disagreed with the orientation of the ultra-left. So I don't think particularly that the like drawn-out debate in the party was really an option. And I think one of the other indications of this is that where the ultra-lefts do take hold, the whole party goes. So it's not the case that it's like an even split in after the conference. One of the leaders of the KPD goes to Berlin, for instance, and attempts to have a talk to the members of the party about why they've chosen this tactic. And 12 people rock up. So there aren't all these people that are particularly open to the arguments of the leadership. And there was already a really anti-leadership attitude within sections of the party, which is indicated by the fact that the Berlin branch had just tried to expel Clara Zetkin. I personally don't think there's a whole lot of evidence that there's like a leadership or a sane current within these sections of the party that is capable of carrying out the argument. So in my opinion, the split, while there are a bunch of limitations to it, it's obviously not ideal, I kind of think it was the only option for the KPD in this period. And it did have some success in the sense that they ended up uniting with the USPD not too long afterwards, the left of the USPD. But I think the most significant opportunity or attempt to stem the growth of ultra-leftism actually comes after this period. It comes when they've merged with the USPD and when the KPD becomes a mass party. This is a period where the party leadership and membership can actually develop their theory and tactics in close connection with the workers' struggle. They can test their theories in a more concrete way. Party tactics can be informed by the participation of thousands of rank-and-file communists in the broader workers' struggle. And this lays the basis, this change in the composition of the party, lays the basis for the tactic of the open letter, which was inspired by the actions of communist workers, KPD workers in the Stuttgart metal unions. And the tactic involved proposing joint activity with the reformist forces around a series of widely popular and widely supported working-class demands. Didn't involve suspending criticisms of the reformists. Instead, it was focused on trying to organise the sort of mass struggle that could actually open up more space for revolutionary politics within broader layers of the working class. And the open letter was hated by the ultra-lefts. The KAPD said that the party created illusions in reformism. They called it demagogic and misleading. Their representatives at the Third Congress of the Comintern said that the tactic was opportunist and can only ever be opportunist. And these criticisms were shared by the developing new ultra-left tendency within the party in Berlin around Ruth Fischer and Ernst Maslau, as well as leading figures in the Comintern, Bukharin and Zinoviev. So despite all the attacks on the open letter, despite all the illusions that it so so-called, supposedly strengthened in the reformists. The reformists themselves also hated the open letter. The SPD, the USPD, and the trade union leadership all rejects the proposal. They polemicise against it in their party papers. I think the reason they do this is because they could actually recognise the tactic for what it is, more than the ultra-left could. They could see that this is actually an attempt to challenge the reformists for political leadership and legitimacy among the broader workers' movement. And so, and at any rate, attacks from both the ultra-lefts and the reformists did nothing to stop a surge in support for the KPD and the trade union movement. And so by early March of 1921, just before the March action, over 2 million workers had voted in favour of the open letter proposals in various unions. And obviously this progress is tragically interrupted by the March action when the new ultra-left leadership proceed to totally destroy this new level of mass support. Another thing about the open letter tactic I think that's notable is that it did leave a political legacy as well. And in the Third Congress and the Fourth Congress of the Comintern, this tactic forms the basis of the United Front theory and tactic. And so, it provides an example that people like Clara Zetkin can use in the Comintern Congresses as an argument for a return to a more sensible strategy. And many people in the KPD leadership who had previously advocated the theory of the offensive basically forced to eat their words after the March action. And, some of them do realise that there's a necessity to return to the tactic of the open letter and the United Front. Okay, so just in summary, I think it's important to see ultra-leftism. It's not just about a few ideas or leaders, but it's a sentiment that grips a significant section of the German revolutionary movement. And while you'd expect this sentiment to be present in any revolution, the lack of a revolutionary experienced cadre meant that the German left was not politically prepared to correct ultra-leftism. It is notable that no section of the communist movement is immune from this ever. Like another example that I didn't really have much time to talk about is the Kapp Putsch, where even after the expulsion of the ultra-lefts, the leadership take another ultra-left position, another conservative ultra-left position, where they refuse to defend the government from a reactionary coup. So ultra-left ideas could easily re-emerge, particularly in a party that had no roots in the class. So I think it was imperative that the more sensible sections of the KPD utilise any options available to them to try and prevent these politics from taking hold and getting worse. Sometimes this involved political debate and winning people over. Sometimes it did involve, and had to involve, I think, splits and expulsions. Because the politics that cohered the KPD did matter. The party had to have a sober assessment of the revolution. It had to understand that there were practical limits that were imposed on it in a period where it's a minority within the class. But it also did have to have an orientation to seeking out where opportunities existed to attempt to initiate struggles where they could, and to increase the organisation and political level of the workers' movement as a whole. So revolutionaries can't just be the carrier of wholly revolutionary rhetoric. You can't be divorced from the existing movement, but you have to be able to point the way forward for the revolution as a whole. And I think at its best, or at its worst, the KPD provides a lot of examples of what not to do, how not to do this. But at its best, I think that the KPD showed that it was possible for revolutionaries to increase their influence and achieve this goal in the midst of the German Revolution.